Paul, it's an honor to speak with you today. Tell me a little about yourself and your interest in the issue of homelessness. How did you get involved?
Basically, through a process of ending up kind of bouncing around from place to place. This was the late 70s, early 80s. We didn't have the tag homelessness yet. We didn't have a homeless problem yet. We just had more and more of us that were finding themselves with nowhere to live on a permanent basis. And living off of sisters, living off of friends, squatting. Went to Europe through a woman I met. Ended up hanging out at squats in Amsterdam and Copenhagen, came back to New York. There was all the Avenue A, B, C stuff going on with the squats down there. And decided to come out to San Francisco. And through the good graces of one of my sisters, was able to get out here. And got involved with Hospitality House in January of 83. San Francisco started its homeless program in October of 82 and have been doing this stuff every day since then.
So looking back over the last 50 to 75 years, we have seen a huge shift in the number and visibility of homeless people in this country. Walk me through what happened and how we got to where we are today.
Well, when you actually go back and look at it from a cause and effect systemic perspective, instead of looking at, well, what drugs were available or deinstitutionalization or like, but something clearly happened shortly before October of 82, because New York City started opening shelters in 81 and police stations, empty police stations were the first shelters in New York City. Here in San Francisco, it was empty muni buses that they put out in front of St. Anthony's and in front of the old welfare department. And it, everything was temporary, short-term, crisis, you know. But yet no one really seemed to stop and look and say, what's creating it? And when we did that, when I was even still at the coalition, so maybe 15, 17 years ago, we, working off of a report that Cushing Dolbrer, when she was still running the National Low Income Housing Coalition, had done, where we didn't ever really bunch of GED from the street dudes. I'll speak for myself. I didn't understand it. And the data that was flowing out of D.C. was a little bit over our heads. And it was like we couldn't use it if we couldn't understand it. It didn't really serve as an organizing tool for us until we pulled out public housing, Section 8, the programs that we knew that we all hung out with, and looked at those funding trends and looked at those charts and then started digging deep into exactly when the cuts came, who was the president at the time, what was appropriated versus what was allocated or whatever. And it showed so clearly that from 1979 to 1983, in 2004 constant dollars, $54 billion a year in affordable housing funding was cut by the federal government. So when you have this cumulative series of cuts that equals $54 billion a year, that then expands its and carries out at $54 billion a year over the next 25, 30 years, you ain't going to do nothing but create homelessness for people that are poor. And so that became a strong organizing tool for rap, especially because we're in all these different cities. So what are the common threads that we all have that connect us as one? And federal funding for affordable housing should be a connecting issue for every poverty-based organization, every social justice-based organization. And I say social justice because over that same period of time, the homeowner mortgage interest deduction program tripled. So it wasn't that the Fed stopped spending money on housing. It was that the Feds reprioritized who benefits from federal largesse in accessing housing. And it clearly went from poor people to home ownership programs, because home ownership programs benefit mortgage companies, realtors, and home builders associations more than it benefits anybody else. And so that became a priority.
So was it just the financial sector that was primarily responsible for this shift, or were there philosophical and political reasons for the shift in funding as well?
The best that I'm able to really speak to with any like sense of confidence in terms of what these guys was thinking, and they were overwhelmingly guys, is Carter in 79 seemed to do this across the board series of cuts. And in looking at the numbers, it was across the board. There was a recession at the time. There was also a gas crisis. There was also the Iran hostages, but there was a recession at the time. Reagan's revolution was taking neoliberal economic policies and making them the bedrock of the United States government. We had tested that stuff for years in Central America and South America. Banana Republic refers to Chiquita Banana Company. So companies ran governments, and governments served companies. And that was tested and played with and tweaked, and people were killed and whatever. Reagan's revolution at its core was commodifying every single priority for the federal government. If it wasn't making money for somebody somewhere in the private market, it had no value to the United States government. The United States government first and foremost priority, and we see that now in our military, we see it in our prisons, we see it in our jails, we see it in our healthcare, we see it in our education, we see it in our housing policy, we see it everywhere. Our public parks are about commodities and about generating revenue for private corporate interest. And if it ain't, whatever it is, if it ain't doing that, then it's not a funding priority. It merits, it's not economic stimulus, and therefore it merits no support, whether it be through tax credits or whether it be through direct funding from our federal government. And the end result of that is people that don't have money ain't getting nothing except more policing, more private security, more jails, and more prisons. And that we seem to be getting ad nauseum.
Was that HUD change in funding priorities related to the reduction in the number of rural affordable housing units constructed, or was there something different going on with that?
No, it was when rural housing funding was created, it was during the New Deal. When HUD, what is now called HUD, was created, it was 1937. So when you think back to the New Deal era, to administer housing funding for local communities, you already had a U.S. Department of Agriculture that was in rural communities. So there was no need to create a new federal government program to administer that funding. You did it through the apparatus that was already there. So USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, as weird as it may sound to some people, has since the 1930s funded affordable housing and home ownership programs in rural communities. HUD was created in 1937 specifically around urban development programs. And a lot of it had to do with the health issues and the tenement housings that existed. And if somebody got a cold, the whole building ended up with pneumonia and hep C and that tuberculosis. And so that's why we all have air wells in our SRO buildings and stuff. Was there was a big, strong health aspect to meriting federal funding for affordable housing development. So they couple each other just based solely on the economic principles of federal funding does not go to support activities and programs and community efforts that are not generating revenue for corporate America. Bottom line, I mean, there's no other – it's so universal. It's so across the board that it was obviously a priority to say, a policy – that. You can see it being implemented in different programs as its life expands. And it's all over the place now. We're mortgaging off public housing. Like, how much more of a commodification statement can you make than to start literally mortgaging off public housing that was created with U.S. tax dollars for the sole purpose of ensuring safe, decent, affordable housing for every American?
So what federal programs have replaced the policy of building and maintaining affordable housing?
As any federal or state or local, as they start deciding to defund an activity or a program, is you always create a smaller version, a cheaper micro version of whatever that program was. So as they have decided to stop funding public housing, which they decided years ago in both maintenance and upkeep and new development and Hope 6 and destroying units and increasing rents, as they started implementing those decisions, there's always a strong necessity to pretend like you're still doing something about the lives of the people that you're screwing over. And so you see it so much in mental health. Like, as residential treatment, which was the solution to the institutionalization, it wasn't putting people on the street and in jail. That was the recommended solution to that. As that got dismantled, all of these little quasi, little semi innocuous little programs started popping up all over the place, and all funded by the state. You know, in that case, because the state was the ones making the deepest cuts. You know, in housing, they're now funding homeless programs. They know goddamn well, since they passed McKinney in 1987, that homeless programs are being created because we're cutting affordable housing. That was in all of the testimony. It was in all of the justification for Reagan, of all presidents, to sign the McKinney Act. Everybody at the table knew that this was a response to the cuts to affordable housing. And now it's the answer to homelessness. What? It wasn't a lack of homeless programs that created homelessness. It was a decimation and the demolition and the selling off of and the defunding of our housing programs that created homelessness. And now our homeless programs are talking about housing first with no freaking housing money. Are redefining when a person is homeless versus when they're poorly housed, so that they can say, we're not turning away homeless people. These people don't qualify for homeless services. Like, it's a freaking welfare program? You don't qualify for these services? What the hell? If you're desperate enough to walk up to a shelter and ask for a place to sleep, who gives a damn whether or not you qualify? You must be in pretty bad freaking shape, especially if you got your kids in tow. And it was the youth and the kids that they are abusing the most with this redefinition. Because they want to focus on single adults. They want to focus on the most visible. And this whole funding stream and technical assistance and National Alliance to End Homelessness and Corporation for Supportive Housing and this whole industry gets created around a pretense of addressing the issues that make up the lives of the people that live in our communities, in order to justify the neoliberal economic policies that actually drive the decision-making process of the United States government. And it's time to call them on this.
Can you describe one or two of these recent federal programs used to address the homeless issue and explain why they never seem to get the traction they need to end homelessness?
Well, the most obvious target these days is Housing First, which is the one that everybody's hearing about, which is the one that when you actually go to look at HUD and look at the federal government's budget and look for the funding stream and the line item, because in the blue book of the federal government is a line item for every single dollar they spend or allocate, there's no line item for Housing First. Housing First was created in the public relations office. It wasn't created in the funding office. And if we really were serious about housing first, we would obviously, of course, restore the funding for housing. How the hell can you do housing first without any housing? So it just begs itself to the ridiculousness and the lack of depth connected to social policy and public policy issues in the mainstream media that you see, and even from the lefty mainstream media. You see all these articles in The Nation and about, oh, how great Housing First is. And in fact, what they're looking at is the Chronic Homeless Initiative, which is single adults only, if you've been homeless for a certain period of time, and in old buildings that used to house poor people. These are not new construction. So you take an SRO building in a low-income neighborhood, you kick a bunch of poor people out of it, you rehab it, you reopen it as a new housing initiative for homeless people, and you put all of your funding and all of your priorities geared towards the chronic homeless single adult for one reason and one reason only, because they are the most visible. And so in rural communities and in every community where, you know, we have massive numbers, we have 1.2 million kids that go to school every day that don't have a home to go to that night. But our number one priority is the visible single adult. And then we wonder why the numbers of families keep growing and the numbers of you know, teenage suicides and abuse and beatings of homeless people, you know, continues to just get worse and worse and worse because people are being told one thing. The reality is something completely different. The days of women and children first are long freaking gone. If HUD had been driving the Titanic, the life rafts would have only been filled with single adults, so you could say you saved more people. And it's a recipe for disaster, and it's blowing up in their face. The other program is point-in-time headcounts. If you really gave a how many people are homeless in America at any given time or over the course of a year, having local communities spend millions and millions of dollars to hire consultants and trainers and staff and vests and flashlights and write reports and do all this because they love to study poverty. They love to study racism. They love to study homelessness because they don't have any intention of addressing any of those issues. But if you really did give a January 25th, once every 2 years, go out and count people sleeping in the streets? Like, how more blatant and obvious could the pretentiousness behind this possibly be? There is no legitimate interest or intent to get actual numbers. There's a legitimate interest and intent to make it look like you give a shit and you want to get numbers. But there is no intent to get numbers that are going to have any meaningful guidance in setting priorities about what's happening in the local community. January 20, and this is national, like January 25th in Bozeman, Montana, in Detroit, Michigan, in Chicago, in New York, in Portland, Oregon, you know, January 25th tends to be pretty freaking cold. So to think that going out and counting the numbers of heads of people that you see sleeping in the streets on that night, and the most amazing part is those numbers that come out from that process are now the official numbers. Just like Reagan did with unemployment. When the unemployment numbers were getting too high, Reagan's people said, well, from now on, the only people that count as unemployed are in employment programs or getting unemployment benefits. Otherwise, we no longer count those people as being unemployed. And voila, the numbers of people in America went way down that were unemployed. And that's the number we use today. That's still, when they talk about 7.9% unemployment or 9.2% unemployment or the unemployment numbers are this or that, It's based on that formula. That is, it's not people with no job. It's people that are not in those programs. That's exactly what the point in time headcount is for looking at homelessness in America today.
We're always hearing, mostly from right-wing politicians and Fox News, that we need to reduce the size of government within our budget. This is often used as an argument for why money is not available to address issues like universal health care, education, and the effort to end homelessness. What is your take on that argument?
I don't think it's that we're hearing it now from right-wing politicians and Fox News. You go back and look at Reagan's speeches leading up to his presidency and the whole time while he was president, and then pretty much every single president except maybe Carter. Well, he was before Reagan. So pretty much every single president since then. Government is bad. Business is good. You look at neoliberal economic policy and writings, government is bad. Business is good. It is the Reagan Revolution. That's what we live under. It's what we've been living under in a progressive state of takeover. You know, businesses are people now. According to our Supreme Court, you know, according to the ultimate law of the land, businesses are people, and they deserve the attention and access and political clout that supposedly goes to people if you can afford to pay for it. So this, you know, Fox News is an offshoot of that. Like anytime, even if you're talking about a local organizing campaign, you create a mission statement. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? You set your goals and objectives, and you lay out your working plan. Don't think that's not what we're up against. Business improvement districts are freaking evil, but it doesn't make them stupid. And also what I've noticed is when you look at the corporate agenda and when you look at the takeover of a country agenda that we're up against, it's long term. They're not thinking 3 to 5. I mean, they are thinking 3 to 5 years. They have a work plan over the next 3 to 5 years, but their goals and objectives are way longer than that. And the Supreme Court decision was one step in that process. Getting Reagan elected was the first step in that process, convincing everybody. And the fact that Democrats are so lame in their defense of what it would be called social programs, and they don't want to say socialism. They don't want to say we have a social agenda. We have a social issue. There's no social justice because somehow that's bad. Like, why wouldn't the United States government want a socially just governance structure? Why wouldn't the government want people to be educated, to be healthy, to be housed? And if they really wanted to support a capitalist system, to have some freaking money in their pocket. Like, why is that considered bad? It's been considered bad because it's been beaten into the heads of all of us for the last 35 years that government bad, business good. So now our downtowns, our public-private partnerships, our parks are public-private partnerships. Our public housing is now going to be a public-private partnership. Our military, it just goes on and on and on. That there is no legitimate role that government plays in the lives of the people that we govern, because the only ones that can do it is private industry.
You are listening to KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno. This is Mike Rhodes, and you're listening to an interview with Paul Bowden. Paul is with the Western Regional Advocacy Project, and he's just finished publishing a book, House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco and Beyond. Sometimes rather than addressing the root causes of homelessness, cities pass quality of life laws to stop homeless people from sleeping or sitting in public, asking for money, pushing shopping carts, etc. What do you think is motivating this criminalization of poverty?
You know, we often use in our organizing a poster from 1936 that was put out by the mayor of New York, funded by the WPA, hired a local artist, and there's all these images in the middle of the poster of poverty and homelessness, and on the top of it, it says, "Must we always have this?" with a giant question mark. And then at the bottom, it says, "Why not housing?" You would never see that today. You would never. We've pitched it to everybody that's run for mayor in San Francisco, anybody that's running for mayor that's willing to talk to us, or any other office. Like, why is local mayors and state elected officials and state departments allowing the federal government to just pull out and get the hell out of the social issues of people's lives, the health care, the education, the housing issues of people's lives? Why are they allowing that to happen? And why are we electing people that allow that to happen? So giving a tax break to Twitter, to take over a building in a quasi low income neighborhood. San Francisco doesn't have a whole lot of low income neighborhoods left, but in a quasi area of low income. In addition to all the tax breaks that Twitter's already getting for being in California from the state, for being Twitter from the feds. I mean, my God, and the tax breaks that you get as a business. My Jesus, lunch, luxury boxes, football games, baseball games, whatever. You know, like, we're already giving massive breaks to these guys. And yet the local government is now also on local taxes. And yet, local government's looking at thousands of people sleeping in its streets. Well, how are you going to deal with that? You're going to use your jails. You're going to use your courts. You're going to create laws that say it's illegal to sit down in public space. Everybody's going to sit down in public space. You know that. I know that. They know that. Everybody knows that. Everybody's going to stand still. Everybody's going to lay down. Everybody at some point in time, whether they like it or not, is going to go to sleep. Everybody is going to have to eat at some point in time. So we're passing all these laws that make sitting, standing, sitting, sleeping, laying down, closing our public parks, making it illegal to eat, making it illegal to serve food so people can eat. And everybody in the game knows, just like with Jim Crow laws, just like with sundown towns, just like with Antioquia laws, everybody in the process knows this is about certain people. This isn't. These are laws that are universal. They're a law. But the application of these laws is about certain people. And it's been Japanese Americans. It's been African Americans. It's been mentally ill people. It's been homeless people. And today, again, it's homeless people. But this has been done against other people. Bostarero treaties. It was about Mexicans, you know, people from Mexico. So, like, you know, everybody in the process knows. And so local businesses push the creation of local laws that are passed by local government, that are signed by local mayors, that are enforced by local police and local private security companies, that are adjudicated in local courts, and people are incarcerated in local jails. It stays in the family. And they can do it. They have the legal authority to put in law, time, place, and manner restrictions in local communities and public space. So they have the authority, they have the ability, they have the desire, they have the will, and apparently, because the one thing that every mayor always tells me is, I can get police money. I can't get no housing money. I can't get no education money. I can't get no healthcare money. But I can get money for cops. And now the freaking Pentagon, well, not now, this has been going on for a while, but the Pentagon will give you unused military equipment as well. You know, when they busted the squats in the Lower East Side back in the late 70s, it was the first time the Pentagon had given unused or unused or unwanted military equipment to a local police department. And they actually showed up in these little armored personnel carriers when they were busting those squats. Eric Drucker was doing a thing at the Howard Zinn Fair the other day and had pictures of it because he lived there. So, again, none of this is new. You know, anti-Oki laws and sundown towns and Jim Crow and ugly laws were, you know, this is not new. It's history repeating itself, because while we overturned Jim Crow, while we overturned anti-Oki, we didn't take away the ability for local governments to enforce and to create and enforce blatantly racist and classist legal legislation.
Maybe a better question is, what can be done to stop this criminalization of the homeless?
Well, our attempt, what we're going for right now, based on 1,300, actually now it's closer to 1,700 interviews that we did with people in the streets. You know, those things I mentioned, the sitting, standing, eating, sleeping, laying down, these are the top three criminal offenses that homeless people of the 1,700 that we've spoken to, and this is by far and away the top three, is sleeping, standing, and sitting. Like, those are illegal acts if you're perceived to be of a certain class. And so we're pushing legislation in Oregon and California, working with a lot of groups in Colorado, working with groups now on a campaign in Washington that says local governments cannot criminalize the act of sleeping in a vehicle so long as it's legally parked, sitting, standing, laying down, eating, or sharing food. Like, that those are protected acts. Those are not, cannot be criminalized anymore in the future. Because those are acts that get criminalized that you know everyone's going to violate. And so the fact that we have historically allowed local governments to pass laws to make it illegal to sleep or to sit or to stand still, you know everyone's going to do that. So our bill says you can't make those illegal activities anymore. Basically under the assumption that if we build power, if we keep working on this, because I don't think these bills are going to be easy, but nothing worthwhile is, and they lose the ability to get rid of us and make us disappear, our right to exist gives us power. And if you can't say, go away, disappear, I'm closing my eyes, I don't want to see you anymore, if you can no longer do that to us, then maybe as human beings, you're going to have to start talking to us, and you're going to have to start dealing with us as human beings and as people with rights. And that I live here, I have a right to be here, and we need to figure out how we're going to work together, because you no longer have the legal authority to make me disappear.
In addition to the homeless Bill of Rights work, what other efforts are you working on to stop attacks against the homeless and return enough funding for affordable housing to end homelessness?
To be honest, I think one is we need to get a hell of a lot more accountable in who our reps are. You know, we're poor people, homeless people, whatever. Like, we're being repped by professionals. And there's a whole industry. And this is the legacy of the war on poverty, is with 501c3s, of which RAP is one. Foundation, charitable giving, IRS codes. There's so little passion and so little visceral connection when you get to City Hall and then you get to the state and then you get to the federal level. The professionalization of who is repping poor people is disgusting. And I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. We're obviously a part of that system. But we do street outreach and we do our community forums as an attempt to say this is who we're representing. So the 1,300 that we have documented, the 1,700 that we've talked to. That's what we're – that sets our priorities. And as organizers and as reps, we have no ability to change that. So we can't cut a deal on the Homeless Bill of Rights campaign that doesn't mirror the priorities that were set from the street outreach and the community forums we did. We can't do that just by the structure that we set up. I'm telling you, man, like, in, you get into D.C., you get into Sacramento, you get into City Hall, that's not standard operating procedure for those that are in there repping poor people. So then local politicians, state politicians, national politicians get certificates and awards and plaques and honored at dinner because they can bring in money to the organization. They get technical assistance grants to implement policies that, damn, wait a second, I thought you opposed Hope 6. And now you're building a Hope 6 program? How did that happen? That kind of short-sighted, self-serving representation of poverty and class and racism in this country has to stop. And the only way it's going to stop is if the National Alliance to End Homelessness holds a conference and nobody shows up, because nobody wants to hear what they got to say. And I'm telling you, that ain't going to happen anytime soon. Their conference gets thousands of people. Because if you want HUD funding, you want to be in good with the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Like, that's just how the game is played. And so to think that those guys are actually repping with passion and conviction the issues of poor and homeless people in their community, that they're not opposing Feinstein's Homeless Children and Youth Act, which would get rid of the redefining family homelessness and youth homelessness so that any family that says I'm homeless is considered homeless. They're opposing it and calling people poorly housed. So now we have a new category of homeless families. There's homeless families, and then there's poorly housed families. And then there's, just like with low income, and then there's extremely low income and extremely, or hunger, where now there's all of these categories of hunger. All these categories of poor, all these categories of homeless. Somebody's benefiting within each of those category areas. Like, those things don't just happen on their own. And they happen because we let it happen. And we let other people define us. We let poverty pimps pimp off us. We let politicians use us and fund us and then defund us when we piss them off. We allow that to happen. And until we decide to stop allowing that to happen, it's going to continue to happen. And I think by the time you get to the point where you're freaking homeless, what else are they going to do? What do you got to lose? You're homeless. So when you start fighting back at that level, Anything, the fact that we even have a punk little office is a hell of a lot more than we had when we started. And we got nothing to lose, because the very worst that can happen is we end up back where we were when we started in the first place, and that is just the way it is. But I don't think most organizers or organizations repping communities understand the power inherent in that statement, that you have to organize like you got nothing to lose, so you just tell the truth. And if you tell the truth, you never have to remember what you said, and you can just keep saying it. I was just, because the street sheet turned 25 years old in a couple of months, I was looking at a video that was done about the street sheet in 1992. It was amazing. The things that people were saying are exactly the things that we're saying today. And somebody said, wow, that's too bad. And I was like, I don't think so, because we haven't won yet. And the fact that it's different, not totally different people, it was cool to see how many were still around. But several had died and several had moved on. But they were talking the same smack we're talking today, and with the same spirit and with the same accountability that we're talking today. And I think, you know, that's an amazing testament 25 years later, that it is that ingrained. Everybody uses their own words, but the spirit and the intent and the accountability behind what was being said is exactly the same thing that we're saying today.
Paul, you've just written a book, House Keys, Not Handcuffs. Tell me what the book is about.
It's about, and actually the full title of the book is House Keys, Not Handcuffs, Homeless Organizing, Art, and Politics in San Francisco and Beyond. Because the book is about, after 30 years, there was like an idea of doing an art book and honoring my 30 years, blah, blah, blah. And it just didn't feel right. And so Art Hazelwood, Bob Prentice, a bunch of other people got together, and this is a collection of essays. It's three essays, one long-winded one from me about the last 30 years of organizing in San Francisco and what we were trying to accomplish and why we did the stuff that we did at the Homeless Coalition, at Hospitality House, and in other places. And also, like, as serving as – when we started in the early 80s coming out of Hospitality House, me and my friends, like, we knew that we weren't doing something new. But there was all these people that wanted to train us and tell us, and how many copies of Rules for Radicals I received back in them days. It could have built us a house. But they weren't talking to us the way that I'm hoping this comes across to people that are thinking about doing stuff. This speaks from the heart to the heart. How you do it, that's your stuff. There's no, you know, Robert's Rules of Order and all that. People don't need to hear that. People get involved in doing organizing work from their heart. And so to reinforce that and to validate that and to give warnings about the power of money and how you deal with money before you have it, so that when it does come, it doesn't take over you, but you control it. You know, the power of accountability, the ability to say we. You know, my first comment when somebody comes to me and says, we think this, is who's we? I only see you. Show me your street outreach. Show me what you've done. Validate who we is before you start saying the homeless this or you know, like whoever you're repping. And also the power of, don't think you're going to win. Like, you know, on the back we have a photo of a direct action, you know, and the quote on it is, it's not important whether you win or lose. It's important that you put up the fight and that you were willing to stand for something and fight for it, and that you're willing to lick your wounds and fight again tomorrow. That's what's important. That's 10 times more important than did I win? Because if you keep doing that, eventually you will win. If what's important about the fight is winning the fight, then get into boxing or play football or play a game. But in social policy and in social justice campaigns, winning the fight isn't the issue. Fighting the fight is the issue. And sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. That's how it goes. Mostly you lose. Certainly on homeless stuff, mostly you lose. But that's not the priority. The priority is that you were willing to fight. And so that's what the first essay is about. The second essay is about how artwork plays such a vital role in that. And there's 67 images in the book, because everything rap touches is about art as our voice, as our messaging tool. And how we've used and learned, and gotten better at creating and using artwork over the years as part of an organizing and public education campaign. And then the third essay is from an awesome dude named Bob Prentice, who was the first homeless czar in San Francisco back in Feinstein's era, or Agnos. I think he was in Agnos's era. And how it was perceived and how it played out and how it looked and how he was able to support and how important it was to have a non-government funded, no holds barred, unafraid, relentless organizing campaign so that he could, on the inside of government, use that to advance more humane policies and more humane programming. So it's an interesting way of giving different perspectives and not claiming to give a history lesson, because I couldn't remember everyone's name. I couldn't remember every group that was involved. It's like, you know, we say in the book, the first lesson of this book is, if you want to write a book like this, start documenting your stuff in the beginning. Because going back 30 years later and thinking you're giving a history lesson is just BS. You ain't. You're giving a perspective. And so, without any fear or hesitation, is the spirit behind what we were doing and how we held ourselves accountable.
In your experience, what organizing models work best to build a movement to protect homeless people's rights and shift priorities at the national level so there's enough affordable housing to end homelessness?
Well, and as soon as we get to that point, I'll let you know what organizing methodology we used, because, I mean, I can speak to the one that we're using now, which is about creating 133 organizations in 5 states that are all working together to try to do some kick-ass stuff. It hasn't protected people's rights at this point, and it hasn't restored affordable housing funding. So I wish, and what I love about with both working now with Colorado and Washington, is their first thing they're doing is street outreach. You know, I think that's vital. I think if you were a union organizer on a plant and you had never talked to anybody in that plant, you probably would not be seen as all that good of a union organizer. I hate when I hear homeless organizers talking about, well, you just can't motivate people. It's like, really? That's not been my experience. You know, it's what are you asking people to do in order to be involved? Because everybody likes to be involved in something bigger than themselves. Everybody likes it, whether they're homeless or not. And, you know, the other point would be, I don't care if you've been homeless. If you're doing street outreach and you're documenting what homeless people say and then we're going through those responses and we're putting them into our forms, it doesn't matter if you've been homeless or not, because you ain't repping homeless people. The people you spoke to are repping homeless people. And I think this whole leadership, I used to write in all of our grants anti-leadership training, and none of the foundations would fund it. Finally, one of the staff people was like, Paul, leave the program exactly how you have it. Just stop calling it that. But my point was, homeless people and poor people got way too many freaking leaders as it is. What they don't have is somebody to clean the bathroom, somebody to dig the trench and actually create a foundation so that we can build off of that foundation. And I think the best organizing, the cleanest organizing, the most helpful long-term organizing is to be a laborer to the movement, not a leader of the movement. And then I think you start seeing progress. You know, and again, going back to that whole corporate neoliberal thinking long-term. And if you think you're going to start doing this and you're going to be the next Martin Luther King, Martin Luther King didn't create the movement. The movement created Martin Luther King. Malcolm X didn't create Islam. You know, like these guys didn't create these movements. These movements created these guys. And you got to think of it that way. And you have to say, my job in this is to be digging the trench and making sure the walls don't fall in and making sure that when we pour the concrete, it's going to settle right and it's going to work. So the next generation can lay the flooring. The next generation can put up the walls. And by the end of the process, people will live in a really beautiful house. But if no one lays the foundation and pours and digs the ditch, that house is never going to be worth standing. You're never going to, you know. Mitch Snyder didn't end homelessness. Like, get over it. And stop looking for a freaking leader. And start looking for laborers. And if you're looking for laborers, you know, we're 133 organizations that are digging ditches. And so you can just join us.
You have been listening to an interview with Paul Bowden. Paul is the executive director of the Western Regional Advocacy Project in San Francisco. For more information about RAP and how to connect with them, you can visit their website at www.raphome.org.